and welcome to Two Fat Expats. And when we say fat, we're not talking bathroom scales or excess luggage. Two Fat Expats are all about making the most of your expat adventure and filling it up with as much as you can so that when it's all over, there's no regrets. You've lived a fat expat life. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie expat who's based in Doha, Qatar. And I'm joined by Nikki Moffat.
Hello.
Another Aussie, but Nikki's in Hamburg, Germany. We've lived in 12 countries between us. We consider ourselves experts in all matters of the geographically challenged. Between us, we've given birth in 6 countries, and we know what it's like to pack up yet another kitchen, start looking for another job, and wave goodbye to that brilliant hairdresser it took you 12 months to find. We've both made those first steps into the brand new office, or worse, the new school, and at times we've found ourselves jobless, friendless, and starting afresh all over again. Each week we talk to expats who are from all over the world, and we discuss our favourite finds, our biggest stuff-ups, and we get the best tips for packing it all in. Okay, are we ready to go? Let's do this. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirsty Rice. I'm relieved the October break is over. I hate when they add that extra day on the end. It's a teacher training day. You have a week off and then you have one day teacher training, which always shortens the week ahead.
I remember someone was telling me they had something like, you know, a 5-week break and then there was a professional day for teachers.
Which I think is important. Don't get me wrong. I think teacher training day is very important, but just have them on a Wednesday on a normal week. I'm all for that. Just don't tack it to the end of my leave when I'm mentally shipping my kids back to school.
Teachers at my school are really well trained. They have so much training. They get training every Tuesday afternoon. We have a half day so that our teachers can have training. And I've heard many teachers tell me that it is such a shock that when you come from your education system in your home country where you have a brown bag lunch, you know, maybe once a month and you maybe talk about some idea, and then you come to the international school where they say, hey, why don't we fly you to Singapore and you can investigate this new way that we're reading.
So it's back to school today, and then it's I'm a bit stressed because it's visa crunch time. So the next 2 weeks are all the visa machinations. So I'll update you on that when that's done.
I'm busting, Nikki, to know more about this because I keep seeing you're asking questions on the Two Fat Expats Facebook group about Copenhagen, almost like you're kind of covering your, well, I'll just find out if this is going to happen, but you look like you're really staying put in Hamburg. So how are you feel? If you had to give a percentage, how are you feeling percentage-wise you're looking at the moment?
Well, to give a more succinct answer on that, the immigration consultants gave it a 50-50 chance several weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working on the 50-50 chance. That's what I'm still working on. But I am gathering last-minute letters and information that I have to provide that will say certain things, which is why I'm asking questions about Copenhagen on Facebook, because I need to know what would be available there versus what's available here, and I have to use that in my argument letters. They have said this week, good chance, but they're immigration consultants, so they can't obviously – they're not giving me a percentage over 50 yet. So it's just balls in the air, throw them all up and see what happens. So hopefully, hopefully this time next week we'll have some sort of answer for everybody I know is on the edge of their seat, just like everyone I know. What about you, Kirsty? What's going on?
Nikki, in my week this week, I'm hosting book group tomorrow night, but it's, there's also been a bit of a conversation about book group because you and I are going to talk about book group next week for the podcast about expat book groups and what they give. But one of the things I had to do this week was put a note out to say that we do have a couple of spots open in our book group. which meant that I've had some really interesting people, is the expression slide into my DMs. I don't know if I don't know if you're sliding into someone's DM when they've asked you to, though, because I did say to people, DM me if you're interested in our book group. But, Nikki, there was a woman called, I'm not sure, maybe she wants me to keep her anonymity, so I might just do that. But her message cracked me up and I thought you might enjoy it. She said, "Hi, Kirsty Rice, how are you?" And then in brackets, talking with Nikki's voice in my head there, she said, "I have a sister named Nikki who honestly sounds so much like Nikki Moffat, it cracks me up. She's been listening to us for 5 years and we've evidently done so much to make her laugh and keep her sane on her wild expat journey. As she's just moved to Doha from Chiang Mai. She's been expat for about 20 years and she's interested in joining our book group." But I did think that was very funny. "Hi, Kirsty Rice, how are you?" So, yes, that's what I've been busy, kids back at school, working, you know, all the rest of it. I've come up with, well, I'll talk about that later. Remind me to talk about something I think I might do when we talk about our podcast and things we've been listening to and reading later on. But, Nikki, this week we're doing something that we've both wanted to do for a long time.
Absolutely. So often when we talk about what episodes we're going to do and when we're planning and just shooting the breeze, we talk about the people that have been on the podcast and people that we've talked to and people that have been interviewed and that we've interacted with over the last six seasons, if you can believe, Kirsty. It's six seasons now. And we wonder if there's been any update in their lives. Because our lives have changed in the last 6 years.
I think you need to take more credit for this because this was really your idea and you came to the podcast with this idea because you were a listener to the podcast before you were a co-host. And so I don't know, I can't remember how many seasons we'd gone for before you came along, but I can remember in the first sort of weeks of you and I joining together to do this, you said, "I'd really like to do a Where Are They Now? I'd love you to go back." And you actually said two of the people that we are talking to today for a "I'd like to know where they are and how they're going."
Yes, because before I joined the podcast, I diligently listened to every single episode again and made notes on all of them so I could appear very knowledgeable when bringing ideas to the table. That was a long time ago. That was four seasons ago. I'm not so diligent anymore, but I was at the time. Anyway, so basically, where are they now? So this week we bit the bullet and we decided to find some of them. Mm-hmm. Now, to jog your memory, Kirsty and our dear listeners, Annabelle was in an episode in season two, which was in May 2016. It was called The Glamorous Expat Life, where you talked about what people think versus reality versus random day-to-day things. And if you remember Annabelle, she was living in Johannesburg at the time and loving her life, but she had some bizarre experiences while she was there and she shared one of them with the podcast.
It's very easy. I can't believe this is a hardship location. I mean, this is ridiculous. So
now, having said that, Annabelle, I did see the reason you kind of caught my eye was we were talking about our days recently on the Four Kids, 20 Suitcases page, and you'd had an interesting afternoon that involved having to come home and have a stiff cup of tea. Tell me about your day.
Well, that was my first sort of shootout incident, which was quite interesting. So where we live, I sort of call it La La Land. We're in an area called Danefern, and it's very posh and estated and fingerprint security and so on. And there's a new shopping centre that's been built just down the road. So I just popped in to get, I don't know, my milk and bread, I think, and was walking out and then heard probably about 12, that sounds like a gun. I'd never heard gunshot before. And then I looked around and there's a big car park in front of me there were people throwing themselves on the floor, crouching between cars, people running everywhere, and I just sort of stood there and froze. I didn't see. It was probably about 500 metres away from me, and it was sort of behind a building, so I couldn't actually see what was going on. But cars were sort of doing swervy U-turns, and it was kind of kicking off, you know. And so I thought, well, what do I do now? So I just went back into the supermarket. I thought, well, I don't really know what to do here. So I sort of sat down and thought about things for a minute, and then I thought, no, I've got loads to do today. So I thought, I need to go home. And honestly, the guys on the sort of the boom gate, you know, the ticket where you pay to leave the car park.
Yes.
Cool as a cucumber. Absolutely cool as a cucumber. I said, was that shooting? He said, oh, yes. I said, okay, fine. I said, I'm British. I'm not used to shooting. He said, oh, it's okay, ma'am. It's okay. You know, and just basically as if it was standard. So, yeah, that was, I mean, it was quite awful because actually about half an hour later, I had to pop out to get my daughter and there was the car. I assume it was the same car that was being shot at with a broken driver's side window with blood down the side of it, which was obviously it had ended sort of in tears. And then I found out later that it was a mother and son and they'd had a row and the son tried to nick the car. So it could be actually quite tragic because it might have just been one of those sort of teenage or whatever fights. Son goes off and then gets shot at by some rather overexcited police. So I don't know. I haven't found out what the follow-up is. But, yeah, so I went home, had a cup of tea, and got on with my day, really. But the first time that I'd ever experienced that, I mean, I've been downtown, you know, I've been around. I mean, yes, you avoid places, you know, at night time and you drive with your windows shut and your doors locked. General sort of rules. There are street rules here that you have to abide by. But in the main, if you stick to those, it's a really great place to live. You know, I mean, I've brought up two teenagers here and it's just great. I think actually probably they have had a more sheltered upbringing in Johannesburg than they would have if they'd been brought up in say the UK, for example, because you can't really let them out in the streets. It's, you know, it's a bit protected like that.
So where to next?
Dar, Tanzania.
Wow. And are you taking... are your children going with you?
No. I'm in a similar boat to you. So my son's just finishing school. He's got his last exams on Wednesday, and then he's hoping to go to university in the UK. And my daughter has decided to go to boarding school in the UK. She's a dancer, so she's got a dance scholarship somewhere. And, yeah, so they're going. My dog, my gorgeous black lab, who's looking at me now, is going to retire to Wales with my parents.
Oh.
And it's just going to be hubby and I. How terrifying. So I bought him a chessboard and DVDs that you wouldn't believe, you know. So I'm just trying to find things for us to be able to do without the children. So anyway, that'll be another challenge.
Okay, so that was South African Annabelle, who was on her way to Dar. But this week I got to speak to the repatriated Annabelle, who is Londoner Annabelle, 2019 Annabelle, who is still just as fabulous. And I said it last time, I am sure that Annabelle would be my friend if we were to meet.
Right. And mine too.
And I still feel that way. And I had a chat to Annabelle. I'll play it for you now, Nikki, so you can hear what she's up to now, and we'll talk again after.
So we left in June 16 from Joburg after the most amazing 4 years. We just absolutely loved it. It was just the best experience ever for us as individuals and also as a family unit. It was great. So my husband had already transferred over to Dar es Salaam, and I was still in SA with the kids, seeing them through the end of school. Then my son went to uni in the UK. My daughter went to boarding school in the UK. And my dog went to go and stay with my parents in Wales. So yes. I was bereft, completely bereft. So then we moved to Dar. Well, in fact, my husband, because I was still in the UK, sort of settling the
kids and the dog in. My husband flew back from Doha to make sure that I was on the plane coming over. So he came to collect me, effectively. So then I did. So I went to Doha. I lasted about 5 weeks. And then I had to come home again for a while to the UK. It was just too much, really, for me with the kids. The umbilical cord was just too tight. And yes. Which is kind of a shame, really. We met the most amazing people in Doha. It was just so fantastic. Not so good for my liver. It is very boozy, but, you know, fabulous people, some of the most stunning sort of beaches. We'd go out sort of 7 a.m, go to this beach that was only accessible at low tide, stay on it for 4 hours, drinking ridiculous amounts, and then get on the boats and come back with dolphins and, you know, job done really for the Saturday. It was incredible. Yeah, it was incredible, but I couldn't volunteer. I'd done loads of volunteering in Joburg and had done some really, what I thought was really fulfilling stuff. And you need a visa to volunteer in Tanzania. It was just so frustrating. So anyway, I was a bit frustrated. And then my husband's company got taken over. So we hooked back to France for a while.
Yeah.
Did about 6 months in France. Then I said, I think we need to go back to UK just because that's where kind of the kids were and the dog was. So we've been back in England for 2 years now. Yeah.
I'd be interested, Annabelle, because I remember you saying that when you were in Joburg that you had, I can't remember if you'd founded the actual charity organisation you worked for or that you had just joined a charity organisation. Either way, you were busy doing volunteer work. Have you done the same in the UK? Have you felt the need to do that sort of work when you've been back in the UK, or has it been a completely different feeling?
So that's a really, really interesting question, because I still have my, it's kind of sound really pants, isn't it, but my giving. I still like to, so I do volunteer for cancer research. I do a shift a week in the shop, which was primarily for me to make friends, because we've moved back to an area where I know no one. We've moved to sort of near St Albans, which is North London, well, sort of in the subs North London, and I know nobody. And it's really hard without children,
yes,
to meet people. And there is no expat community. Well, there probably is, but there's nothing established. You haven't got the inns that you would have, you know, in overseas. I went there, but I absolutely love it. So I've done that, but then I've actually started working again. I'm a graduate recruiter and an HR person, so I've gained traction again with my own consultancy, which has been fantastic, because it's filled that void of me needing to be busy and do and use my brain cells. But it is nowhere near as fulfilling as the volunteer work that I did in Joburg. So it is a quandary, really, because there are needs here. There are massive needs here in the UK. They're just not as evident as going into a township in northern Johannesburg. You know, it's not right in front of your eyes. So, I think probably I'd still like to do more volunteering, but, you know, my work's taken over, really, and that takes up most of my time at the moment.
And how's your husband coping with the move, being back in the UK?
Yeah, he hates it. he absolutely adored working for his old companies, and he absolutely loved them. The company culture was amazing. They were bought out, and I think everyone that we know that has worked for that company has found it difficult to replace that company culture, you know, and that sort of feeling of belonging at work. So he's working now for a different organisation. He's fine. I mean, we love being accessible for the children. We travel quite a lot. We're actually off to Kenya on Saturday, holidaying and so on. We still can't get Africa out of our system. It's great, you know, so we love all that the UK has to offer. The transitioning back is quite interesting. The winters are long, so we're actually also trying to book a holiday for January to go get some sunshine. But I think the biggest thing in terms of repatriating for both of us has been not having those established accessible networks, you know, like in Joburg. You know, we had the school, but expat groups are so friendly. They're just so friendly. They're so welcoming. And, you know, I read this time and time again on your blog and on other stuff. Repatriating is difficult because we'd only been out for five and a half years. But coming back in, it's tough. really tough, really tough.
Yes.
You know, not impossible. I'm always very positive, but tough. Yeah, tougher than being in a shootout in Joburg.
Now, those 5.5 years that you had out of the workforce, how hard was it to get a job back in recruitment again?
Hard. Hard. So I think that I have really valuable skills from an outlook and, you know, sort of general worldliness, for want of a better term, from living the life that I lived for the last, you know, for the last X and seeing what I've seen. You try to go back into London, for example, and you've been out and they tell you that you're not current enough, is like a wet fish in the face. So I decided to just do my own thing. And in fact, was very, very lucky with networking, weirdly, through a friend of mine who's currently living in Hong Kong, who said, got a friend of mine in the UK looking for something. And so, and then we hooked up. And then it's gained traction. So it's actually, it's luckily now I'm in the great position of actually turning work away. I'm completely flexible working, so I can take it to wherever I want. We've got a place in France, so I sort of, we kind of live between those two places, you know, UK and France. I'm very lucky. It's all about networking. It's getting yourself back out there, but really only when your head's in the right place. And, you know, coming back in, it has been tough. Yeah, so, but no, I mean, now it's great. I'm settled. I've got a couple of friends, two, I think, in the local area. life's sweet. I'm always very much make the most of what you've got, you know, wherever you are. We're very lucky. Yeah, just have to get on the plane back out to Kenya again or Joburg or wherever.
When you went to, now, I always thought it was Tanzania, mm. but I have heard other Africans say Tanzania.
Yeah.
So I'm never quite sure what to say. But when you were there,
Tanzania, the people who live there.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm going back to
that. But I think the South Africans say Tanzania. Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I've heard it here. Yeah. And I trusted the South Africans. Are you, meant to say, are you telling me that? But tell me, because now that you've had that bit of time of your children getting a little older,
yeah.
If you had to head off on that expat adventure again, do you think you'd do it in a heartbeat?
Like,
do you think you'd be able to be
100%.
Right?
100%. Yeah. In fact, actually, spoke to my husband and said, can we do one more? Can we just go and do one more? Now that the kids are settled, you know, I mean, they're still at university, but they're pretty settled and happy. We've still got the dog, bless her, so you know, we crossed that bridge. But if there was an opportunity that came its way to us, oh, my God, absolutely. It was the most amazing experience that we've done as a family. And for me personally, couldn't work out there, but the volunteering I did was sensational and so good for me as for my own well-being, you know.
Okay, wow. So she said she was moving to Dar in the first part, but that's a massive change. It's not just moving country. So many things happened. Her children left and went to different places and weren't there with her anymore. So that was not just moving country as is. That was moving country and then having a massive life change because she couldn't volunteer, which is so frustrating after her amazing volunteer experiences in South Africa. And I loved when she repatriated that she volunteered to make friends. That's a good repat. To make friends in her local area. So she was at the shop and so she would see people in her local area that would come into the shop, which I thought was great. Obviously, love Annabelle, love her sense of humour. Repatriating is difficult, tougher than being a shootout in Joburg. I like that she pointed that out. And that she had no established networks, which was very difficult, which I think, and she said, I think that they're away for just 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, 5 years isn't that long a time. I mean, a lot of things change, but when I think about we've been away for 16 years, we've just got nothing. We've got no, like when we return, depending on where we return to, we really don't have anyone or anything on the ground. And I just got to say one last thing, Kirsty. We have talked about this before. You may never trust South Africans on their pronunciation of Tanzania. I don't know why they do it. I don't know why. It's weird because they live in Africa and Tanzania say Tanzania. I don't know. There must be a history. Can some South African tell us why they say the wrong thing?
Yes. Why, dear South Africa, why do you say Tanzania even though the Tanzanians living next to you tell you that that's not how you say it? It would kind of be like if we just started calling New Zealand New Zealand or something and told everyone, no, that's right, it's New Zealand. Okay, Nikki, I want to hear about Valentina because I have been texting and messaging Valentina for many, many years. And she popped up in the podcast back in 2015 when there's no other way to describe it except to say that she was simply miserable. Just have a listen.
Valentina left a comment and she said, I can totally relate. I hate Houston, but even more precisely, I hate myself being in Houston. Yeah. It doesn't matter how hard I try, I just don't fit into this culture. Valentina's European.
Right.
In these habits, in this type of world, I feel like sometimes a day is quite okay and I didn't cry and I didn't feel desperate. But then I enter home and I see this thick, stupid carpet everywhere and it's 90 degrees and I break down like as if I'm something really, it's something really outrageous and important. I hate myself for crying about carpets, but I just can't get out of it. I would pack for the northest village of Scotland or the eastern village of Turkey tomorrow. Just get me back to Europe.
Oh, Valentina.
I know, but isn't that exactly what we've just said? Yeah. She hates herself for getting so upset. Yeah. And there she is living in this really, you know, she's in America. You're meant to be in, you know, one of the luckiest countries.
Yeah.
But she just hates it. And I think, too, if you're European and you're living in a city that is this massive, big, vacuous kind of strip mall.
And Houston is not in New York or in LA where it has some European qualities to it.
Well, the bizarre thing about Houston, I have to be fair to Houston, they have an amazing art scene. And that's the thing. The Australian director of the Australian Ballet, he went to Houston.
Right.
And so it does, but it's all in the city. And the only thing that happens in the city in Houston is that corporate life and the arts and whatever. If you're out in the burbs, and Houston's a massive city, so you can live 45 minutes out.
Right.
You know, and you never go into the city because it's got all those little subcultures. Cultures and big malls and strip malls and whatever.
Okay, Kirstie. So I spoke to Valentina this week, and Valentina now lives in the Bay Area in the US. She's on her second stint in the States. But anyway,
I don't feel sorry for her anymore at all that she's living in the Bay Area, unless there happens to be an earthquake or something, then I do. But no, apart from that, no.
So anyway, I'll let her explain to the listeners and to yourself when you can have a listen about what happened after she wrote in about Houston in 2015. I will let you know before we listen that the sound does change near the beginning. We had 10 or 12 Skype dropouts. And so at one point I just had to throw it all in the air and then I called her on her phone using Skype. So the sound does change, but it's right at the beginning. It's a tiny little thing. So here's Valentina now.
And then was that my husband didn't win the H-1B visa lottery, so our visa finished, and you can imagine how sad I was to leave.
So because of this, we were sent back to UK because we didn't need a visa, and so I had this my little bit of luck, which allowed us to leave Houston after 16 months, and I never missed it even for one day. I found very good friends in Houston. I'm always in touch with them. And I took your advice during the podcast. I discovered that I can understand contemporary art. There is plenty of it in Houston. Yeah. So at least that was the good thing of living there. But mostly, you know, when we moved to Houston, I was so upset for myself, you know, because I was losing my community in Warsaw. And the kids were very small, so it was not so much about them. And that was the last time, because since then, after Houston, we moved to London and then we moved back to States, to Bay Area, where I am now. And since moving to London and the kids being like 4 and 6, I realized that since then, moving is not anymore about me. It's about the kids. If the kids are happy, I'm happy too. So my like take on the expat life has changed completely. Now, you know, Moving back, London was a blissful time, and moving back to States, thanks to Houston, I was so much stronger because I knew already all the possible cultural shock. I knew already how to drive because I learned in Houston. I was prepared. So when we moved back here, it was just about the kids, just making happy the kids. And I was not caring anymore for myself. So in a way, Houston was my immunization.
So, and how old are your kids now?
They are now 9, 7, and 4.
Wow. So now you've got more kids than you had before as well.
Yes, actually, I was pregnant in my end of third trimester when we made the first podcast. So I think that partial part of all my sadness was also given by the hormone swirls.
You talked about learning the lessons about Houston and then about having kids and it being different. How did they feel about living in the States? Did you make it sound like it was going to be fun? Did they remember being in Houston before?
They do remember Houston, but they were still very small. And me and my husband, we were still like the majority of the world. When we moved to London, that was the moment they created their own little world with their friends, the teachers. They bonded immediately in the English school and they really loved London. So moving to California was not something that they were happy about. And this is why that was my main focus. I knew that we were taking 3 very happy children away from their friends, their school, their world, and bringing them here. And that's why, you know, I was just focused about like try to make it like the best possible given the situation. The first 8 months, there were like tears every day from my children. But, you know, now we are talking and I can tell you, we finally have picnic at pickup. We finally have parties. We finally have play dates. So I managed to recreate them a small world here. Of course, they will come back to London in a second, but at least, you know, we went through all the bad parts and, you know, now it's working. And I could be so strong for them because I was prepared on myself. I didn't have to lose one hour being sad for me because I was ready. So I just focused all my energy on them.
And do you have a community in the Bay Area where you are now as well?
I've been lucky that the last few months since my children finally found their tribe, actually many of the moms of their friends are becoming my friends as well. And so now it's a small community, nothing compared to my world in London. But it's enough for me to be happy that at least I don't have to like live attached to my mobile. I can, you know, see someone for a dinner or go for a coffee. It's not a lot compared to what I have in Warsaw and what I have in London. But it's anyway like something that I'm grateful for because I was prepared for the worst and I was okay also with that. So whatever comes, because I have zero expectation, it's anyway a gift.
Oh, I thought Valentina's was a real coming of age almost, wasn't it? With Valentina, that sort of looking back in retrospective that her life has just changed completely and that really that first move almost really prepared her for all the next moves that were to come, but she didn't realize at the time, you know, that all that hard stuff of getting to Houston and having to learn how to drive on the wrong side of the road and the culture shock of being in America and all that stuff then just made it easier the next time when she got to the Bay. And I loved the look at that you really are a cheerleader when you're a parent. Like, and I believe that when one of you is working full time and the other one is doing, you know, the looking after small kids and tends to be stuck with a lot of the grunt work of the moving, that person almost becomes the cheerleader for the whole family. And that's what makes it so hard, is because you're the one trying to keep everybody going. This is going to be okay. This is great. We're all having a good time. This is wonderful. Even if on the inside you're thinking, I hate this and I don't like this and this is too hard, but you're trying to keep everybody else going.
Yeah, I totally agree. And interesting to note is Valentina is Italian. but they moved from Poland because her husband is Polish. So a lot of Europeans don't necessarily view their internal moves within Europe as expatriate postings.
Yes.
They sort of view it as being in another part of the country, like the bigger country, as long as the EU still exists, I guess. So it was interesting that she was, but also she was pregnant, as she said. So got to cut a bit of slack about crying over the carpets.
I remember crying over the carpets. I remember moving to Canada and we had moved from Libya. And so everyone just assumed that we were going to be so, so happy to be in Canada, you know, because, oh, my God, you came from Libya. I bet you're happy to be here. You know, I bet you're happy that you can go to the supermarket. I bet you're happy that you can do all these things. And I wasn't happy at all. I was very happy in Libya. And my husband chose us a pink house. And when I say pink, it was pink on the outside and pink on the inside. They called it, they gave it some Californian name to make it, you know, like salmon or something to make it sound like it wasn't pink. But it was pink. The carpet was pink. The curtains were pink. The bathroom was pink. The outside was pink. It was, and it was right smack in the middle of the burbs. And I just remember looking at the carpets and the curtains and my Dodge Caravan that I was driving around and, yeah, being really not digging my new North American life at all and being quite miserable. But once again, I had, I think, a 5-month-old, an 18-month-old and a, you know, nearly 3-year-old or something, or she was 3. And you know, you were in the middle of, you know, getting people to play groups and, you know, trying to do everything. But, I totally got Valentina's distress.
Can we also point out, though, that one of my big banging on points is you didn't leave properly. You didn't leave Libya properly. Mm. So you weren't ready for a new place because you hadn't left well.
I don't know. I think my life was definitely, Nikki, definitely credit to that I didn't leave properly. Although I had 4 months living with my parents and my 3 children under 4 without my husband in between, right? Because we moved at that was the one where we got the phone call on Christmas Eve saying you're moving. And so we just stayed put until we got the visa for North America. So I had a big break, but yeah, you're probably right in that I still mentally didn't want to be there. I wanted to be somewhere else. Yeah.
That's part of it. And the other part is it's not as exotic and you're not as, it's not, the communities aren't as strong, and because the harder the places to live, the stronger the communities that exist.
Yeah. And exotic is exactly right, because I think there are many expats that say, well, I only do it for the exotic. You know, if I'm going to live in the burbs with a Dodge Caravan and, you know, catching the bus to work every day, I can go home and do that. Do you know, I'm not getting that experience. But that's only a certain type of expat too, I think, because there are many expats that happily head off to London, Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, that want similarities to their home lives. They don't want things to be too exotic. They don't want it to be too hard.
They don't want a goat in the basement.
No. Whereas they don't want an emergency, as you know, they don't want an escape room, or they don't want those things.
No, but I also think it's the transition from those two locations. So, as well as the leaving and the mental thing and the whatever, it's a transition between something that's really, really different to something that is a little bit like you could have been living in Adelaide. Not sure you ever would have had Dodge Caravan there, but something similar you would have had. May not also have had a pink house, but also you would have had the same thing, getting your kids to childcare, going to school, catching the bus to work. And as you exactly said, why would I do this when I could live at home and do the same thing?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Nikki, I loved doing that. I want to do it again. I want to do the Where Are They Nows. Maybe if some of our listeners have got people that they'd like to hear from. I know we have
expat divorce and where are they now? We're going to have an episode coming up with a couple of people we've spoken to in the past. But if you've got someone that you've heard on the podcast that you'd really love to hear what's happening with them or how it panned out or how they went, please shoot us a note. Now, if you are going to www.2fatexpats.com, you will see that there's a little microphone on our website and you basically just click on the microphone and you leave your message. Now, I think anyone and everyone can do that from their laptop, whether they're using Safari or they're using Chrome. It'll work for you. You just click on the microphone and you go. If you're using your phone, if you have an Android, you need Chrome, and if you have iOS or an Apple, you will need the SpeakPipe app to be able to do that. But we would love to hear you, because we just love to hear your voices, and it injects much more life into the podcast than just you and I, Nikki, right?
people are sick of us.
So just tell us who you'd like to hear from, and we'll go track them down and find them. Now, Nikki, three favourite things. Give me one of your favourite things this week.
Okay, so one of my favourite things. So, Kirsty, you and I do follow different football codes. That's very clear. And this week or this month is the Rugby World Cup in Japan. Mm-hmm. And sadly, Australia were bundled out on the weekend. Well, bundled, stomped. They walked over us on their way to the next round.
It wasn't good at all.
But before that happened, a friend of ours in the States formed a little WhatsApp group and sent to my husband and I an article from The Atlantic, and it was called The Best Athlete Americans Have Never Heard Of. And it was in the wake of, I have to say, to put the context down, it was in the wake of the tweet for the NBA where the GM of the Houston Rockets wrote a tweet that said, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." And then it was swiftly retracted. And there is a lot of pressure in American sports to be on the straight and narrow, and also corporate interests are hugely involved, and China has a huge financial interest. And I'm sure anyone that's following that story, there's many, many articles and many podcasts about that particular incident that's come out in the last couple of weeks. Yes. But this particular article, The Best Athlete Americans Never Heard Of, was about David Pocock, who is an Australian rugby player. He was born in Zimbabwe and his family emigrated to Australia. And so he has interests in both countries, but he grew up in Australia and he's played rugby for Australia. And it just talked about how kind of a bit like a stand-up guy he is. So he has, while he's a rugby player, he's a very key part of the team. He's retiring now from the Australian team, but he has played for 10 years. But he's also done other things over that time that have been quite politically active. So in 2014, he chained himself to mining equipment in New South Wales to protest the expansion of a coal mine. He and his now wife refused to get married until same-sex couples were allowed to get married in Australia. So they got married after that ruling had passed. Mm-hmm. In Zimbabwe, he's done things where he's been supporting anti-poaching initiatives and sustainable farming and poverty reduction. So, and even he goes down to, like, he paints his boots all black because to obscure logos, because he can't be sure of the labor conditions of the people that bought his shoes. So he doesn't want anyone to sort of use that in any way as marketing. And at the moment, he's also currently enlisting his teammates to offset their carbon footprint in the World Cup by investing in a solar farm. So here's what you would say, pretty politically active. And one time he was known to stop a game to protest a homophobic taunts that were given to an opposing player. And that was several years ago. And he was criticized heavily for that. Whereas now he's been sort of, and it shows that how rugby has changed or how the game has changed or even how society has changed in that would now be a very acceptable and laudable thing. But at the time he was called into a lot of criticism for that. Now, he's not the only politically engaged rugby player. If you're at all involved in Australian rugby, you'll know about a couple of others. But, Kirsty, you often talk about the great stories from AFL and why you love it so much.
Yes.
Are there any politically engaged AFL players, or is that something that they keep out of it, or how does that work?
No, they do. In fact, the AFL itself is very political, in that they often get, you know, there's often many discussions about whether the AFL itself should be as political as it is, because they have the gay pride round, you know, where the teams changed their rainbow colours, and they, how they market it very much is amongst players telling their stories, and whether that is because they are gay or their brother's gay or their sister's gay or whatever. I think it's really interesting you're saying about the branding with the shoes with Pocock, because I think, you know, that's where a lot of players make their additional income from, isn't it, from that sort of sponsorship. Yeah. And so, yeah, there are certain players that do the same thing. They refuse to be kind of bought. But then, you know, you see it with with the NFL season on in America at the moment, you see how much of it with clothing and sponsorship is just such a big thing of how they're making their dosh. And, you know, when they give you the walk through their cribs and they're, you know, showing you all their different brands of everything they've got. But yes, it is, there are many characters like that that are highly admirable for their beliefs.
Yeah, so I just thought it was interesting that it was an American friend who doesn't follow rugby at all and just sent this to us. So, and I thought it was a really great article, and it was one of my favorite things this week. I was hoping I could say, because we're going to play in the semi-final this week, the Australians. Right. Unfortunately not.
Hey, I thought one of the other things that was interesting with the World Cup was, I think it was the Canadian team, that when they got knocked out, they then went and helped clean up from the tornado damage that had happened at the time. Like, they just got straight into their civvies and got on the bus and went and helped out in a little Japanese town. And I just thought, these are the stories I love from all sports. Do you know, when you
see and it's about teamwork, and it's just and community engagement. And I think the teams that do that a really great job of that. Yeah. I mean, it's just shock. It's very sad that what happened during the World Cup, to the World Cup as well as to the Japanese community. So, they've had the whole weather situation. Okay, what about you, Kirsty? What have you got on your list?
Okay, so in regards to podcasts, there's a new Dolly podcast, as in Dolly Parton. Have you seen it?
Oh, I haven't listened, but I have seen it.
It is good. So I'm back on, because obviously AFL over, I'm back on my variety has increased with podcasts. So I saw it and thought, oh yeah, Dolly Parton. Yeah, I like Dolly. I don't mind Dolly. I'm ambivalent about Dolly. You know, a couple of songs that I really like, have liked a lot of the stuff, bizarrely, that I think Miley Cyrus has almost given Dolly a bit of a resurgence, because young people know who Dolly is now too, because of that. And but this podcast, as far as podcasts go, has been really brilliantly researched and produced. There is just so much more to it than just Dolly. It's kind of what makes Dolly, and looking at the times for women in her era. And one of the things I took away from it that I just thought, this is good, this is when you know people have really done their research, right? So the first episode is called something like Sad Ass Songs, because Dolly tells you, you know, I wrote a lot of sad ass songs in her, you know, early career. And they look at those songs that she wrote, and that they were quite often from a female perspective and whatever, but she talks at one stage about the death of a woman who was drowned, and it comes out that, well, no, I sang that because that was a story that was told to me, or a song that was sang to me when I was a child. And so the guy goes and researches and finds out that this story of this woman who was drowned is actually from back in the 1600s when it was first told. And what it was the public hanging of the man who drowned her. That back in those days, people who wrote songs would go to the public hanging, hear the person's story, and then write a song that was their story. And they would quite often write on behalf of the person that was hung or the victim. And so this that's how old this story was. And so they went back and they found, you know, this Englishman who'd written a book about poems that were written back in those times and then told you the story. Yeah. Like,
it sounds like a podcast with a very big production budget.
Yes. And that's what else is beautiful about this, because the man who is hosting the show, who's doing all the Dolly interviews, the whole premise behind him getting hold of Dolly and doing this is because his father, who is a doctor, actually became Dolly's doctor when she was ill. He was called in to look after her. And he came home and said to his son, oh, I've met Dolly Parton. And he had this sort of relationship with Dolly that the doctor did, because he was going, she was then going to see him for follow-up stuff. And then he said, would you mind if my son interviewed you? And that's how it all came to be. So anyway, I'm loving it. I think I've just rolled the second episode and I'm really enjoying it.
Okay, I'll download it.
I should say the music, of course, is great.
Of course, the music.
Yeah. Yes.
That's fantastic.
Okay, what else have you got, Nikki?
I'm rewatching. So yesterday a new trailer came out for The Crown season 3.
Yes.
Very, very exciting. And so I'm rewatching season 1 and 2 to prepare myself for the launch of season 3 in November. I remember now how much I really enjoyed it and how I enjoyed the actors in those roles, and how the Matt Smith, who was formerly Doctor Who, but I can only ever think of as Prince Philip.
Yes.
I'm really concerned about how I'm going to transition the characters in my mind. Claire Foy to Olivia Colman. And then Helena Bonham Carter playing Princess Margaret. But then I saw this trailer yesterday, even as I'm mid-watching the other thing. I thought, oh, no, I'm sold. I mean,
yes.
But
yes.
I think whatever they've done such a brilliant job that, well, I can't say so much of Prince Philip, but I was totally sold on Olivia Colman and on Helena Bonham Carter. So I'm excited. I mean, very excited about The Crown season 3. Are you watching anything?
Yes. Nikki, I am watching Modern Love, which is just absolutely superb. I'm watching it on Amazon Prime. It's actually what made me convert to Amazon Prime or sign up because I have been a Modern Love fan right through the process. So for those who are New York Times readers, you would know that Modern Love is like an essay that comes out in the New York Times. And I think I thought I read something the other day saying that they get about 10,000 submissions to Modern Love, because it's anyone can put in a submission for Modern Love. The criteria is it's a 1,500 word essay. And in the old days, I think they used to promise that they'd get back to you within 2 weeks to tell you if you'd been successful or unsuccessful. And now they say maybe 4 months. We're not really sure, do you know, how quickly we'll get back. So it started just as the essays, and then it moved to a podcast, and you could download all the podcasts. And so what they would do with the podcast is they would, you know, use sometimes an actor to come in and read the essay. And so I listened to the podcast, and now it is a television show. And so they've picked 8 of the essays and converted them into episodes. And it is absolutely brilliant. There's 8 of them. I've done 7 of them. I've got 1 more to go. And absolutely everyone in my family has really thoroughly enjoyed every single one. They've scored amazing people for the shows. They've had Anne Hathaway, Tina Fey, that lovely Silver Fox from Mad Men, whose name I've forgotten. I think he's Roger someone, sorry. But they've had fantastic talent all the way through, and the stories are brilliant, and it is all set in New York, so it's, you know, just beautiful to watch and just stories so well told.
Okay, haven't read it, don't listen to the podcast, so I think I'm going to have to do that before I even go and look at the TV show.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to, and I mean, I know you're more an audio person than a reading
person.
And no, but articles, I can manage a 1,500 word article. Let's not sort of write me off totally there, Kirsty.
I think you would enjoy this series even if you hadn't read the articles, for sure. And I think what you might even enjoy is now I listened to something last night where they've now doing a few podcasts where they're using the people, they're going back and talking to the original author about how they felt about the actors that played them and, you know, sort of wrapping it all. They've gone full circle.
All right. The last thing I had this week on my three favorite things is startups. And I've talked about startup seasons before, different seasons. But this season, they're doing a three-episode series. And if you listened to the first season of Startup and loved it as much as I did, which I totally did, you will love to listen to this too because it's a story. So Startup first season was how they set up Gimlet Media, which does all these amazing podcasts, Reply All, Science Versus, great podcasts. And now then in February this year, I think they sold Gimlet to Spotify for $200 million.
Gosh.
And it's brutal. Like there are some very brutal, difficult, hard conversations in it where the two founders, they're not getting on because the business isn't going that well. One's a creative, one's a finance person. So it's really interesting in the difference between what a creative does and what someone who's worked in NPR, in National Public Radio. So how much time, effort, and budget they think should be allocated to a podcast and then someone who's the business overseer, how much time, effort, and budget that person thinks because the podcast has to make money. So they have to get advertisers, they have to do all that kind of stuff. They did that one quite controversial podcast that got panned a lot, which was the Habitat one, where the people were pretending to be on Mars and they were sort of kept in a dome for a long period of time, for 12 months or something, and they had all this tape and then they had to edit it down. I think it took them 2 years to make that podcast, like with all the tapes and information that they had. So, and it just, it's really interesting because you think about our podcast and what we do and how we have our little meeting and then we have our Google Doc and then we do our recording and our couple of edits. And to hear what goes into sort of like high level podcasts is pretty amazing, but also just the conversations that the record. So he took his recorder, they took the recorder everywhere. They took it to, you know, meetings between the founders, meetings with Spotify, the whole thing. So it really is a really interesting insight. And I haven't finished the whole thing yet. I'm one and a bit episodes through, but I really wanted to mention it because I think it's great.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying it. And I think if you love Startup Season 1, you should listen.
My last one is the Big Day Out podcast. And the Big Day Out was a huge festival in Australia that kind of originated right in the height of my Triple J listening music time. So I think this might just be a personal one for me, and maybe it's definitely very Australian. So I'll keep it brief for those that are going, oh, she's talking about Australia again. But it's a behind the scenes on how sort of the Big Day Out started and all the drama that was behind it. But it's also this beautiful naivety and look at the times that we lived in then. You know, one guy says at the time, the guy who started the Big Day Out started as a music promoter. He was like posting signs up against walls. You know, when you'd see those people like sticking the signs up all over the pub walls and with their rollers and their whatever, you'd get paid, you know, $25 to promote a concert that was going to be at a pub, you know. And so he then ended up doing this, you know, multi-million dollar Big Day Out. But it's interesting, Nikki, you're talking about with Startup, because they had the same thing with Big Day Out. They had one person who was creative and one person that was business, and they ended up, they couldn't even speak to each other. They used to have to fax each other, and sometimes those faxes just involved two words.
With one off or you?
One of those was off. But it was really, it's a time stamp because the first band that they had for the Big Day Out was Nirvana. And
oh, wow.
Yes, and they talk
about the behind the scenes of that, of Kurt Cobain, and they talk about how they smooshed all of these people into a space, but also how one person says, I knew that I was a part of something that was going to be one of those things where people, it was going to be such a gig that people went, I was at that Nirvana gig, you know, where everyone go, oh my God, were you, you know, and they have great sort of interviews with different bands about where they were or if they were in the room and who else was there. Michael Hutchins showed up to get in, you know. The lead singer of UMI, Tim, I've forgotten his surname, but he sort of says he can remember getting in there and just thinking, where are the exit points? Because there were so many people smushed in there, and then thinking, oh, well, if this is how I go down, that's okay. So it was really, really good. And of course you get, because Triple J are around, you get all of that live sound from each different venue. Yeah. And there's also one entire episode that is devoted to the death of a young girl at the Big Day Out and how it affected the promoters and the people that were there and the people that never, ever got over it, because she was the ultimate of the type of person they were trying to get there, in that she was a complete music fan. And just, I think there was a lot of guilt there. So it is really, it's a goodie. So the Big Day Out podcast.
It's a historical moment. It's a point in time, right, as well. And it's very of our generation. So, yes. No, I'm definitely going to listen to that. Kirsty, you said you wanted me to remind you about something, but I've already forgotten what it was.
Okay, so I have decided, and I'm thinking that you, being the person that gives me so much grief about writing and my lack of, is when we were watching Modern Love, my husband said, why don't you do this? Why don't you write one of these and submit one? So I said I would. So I've come up with my idea of what I'm going to write. I won't tell you now. But it's going to be my Christmas present to myself, is I'm going to give myself enough time to just sit down and write my 1,500 words, and then I'll send it off and we'll see what happens. It'll be a slow process because it's going to take 4 months for them to get back to me. But I figure, well, what could be lost? Because if I don't if it doesn't get used, we'll use it here for 2 fat expats or 4 kids, 20 suitcases.
I'm very excited to hear that, Kirsty. You know, I'm the biggest fan of your writing and supportive of your writing a book, constantly supporting. And it's not like you haven't been published in the New York Times before.
This is true. This is something I like to tell my boss often. But yes, and my husband very nicely, that article that was published in the New York Times all those years ago, I don't know if I ever told you, Nikki, that he had it printed by the New York Times has its own printing place, you know, wherever, and you talk to them and they will print your article for you on the masthead and show the page that it was on and what it looked like and the whole thing. So ours hangs very proudly in our toilet.
Oh, it's in the pool room. I was going to say, I'm sure I've seen a photo of you in front of it. That's where it was.
Yeah, it's in the toilet. Unless because how he did it was he did it as a present. And I was away and I came home and it was there on the wall in the living room. And, of course, my first reaction was, oh, my God, take it down. That's so embarrassing. You know, nobody wants to see that. I look like a big bragger, blah, blah, blah. And he said, okay, well, where do you put it then? And I said, well, let's put it in the loo, because people are always looking for reading material when they're in the toilet. And it's not too, yeah. It doesn't feel too braggy, do you know, if it's in the loo.
It's in the loo.
Yes.
How many people go in and come out and say, Kirsty, I never knew you wrote for an article that was printed in the New York Times?
No one actually ever does. I think I had one friend who had been to our house a lot of times, and he said, you know, I've looked at that New York Times article. I've never registered that it was you that wrote it. So I think most people.
Obviously he was having some time. He was thinking about it then.
Anyway, that was my point. I won't go on about it. But, yes, that's my little project. So you can now start to harass me about that instead of the book.
Okay, but I just don't want you to have too many projects because you've got that. You got your five friends for Christmas. So let's keep it up on the projects.
Got it.
I spy with my little expat eye.
Do you have something, Kirsty?
So I spy with my little expat eye. We have Kumi's Japan. And the reason I thought this was such a poignant expat piece is this is all about Kumi, who grew up in Australia, but she says, what does it mean to choose a home and what does it mean to have a home chosen for you? And I guess her feeling is that her parents chose that they would move to Australia, and she says that her heart just isn't in Australia and she doesn't have that sense of home. She says, I love Australia, but there's another part of me that I need to explore. And then so you basically watch Kumi go back to Japan to explore that side of her. And I think from an expat sense, because this is more about a child that has immigrated and then gone back to reclaim, so it's not such an expat story, but she says something in it that I think is very expat, in that she's talking to people in Japan and she's saying, my experience of being asked where I'm from has always been very negative. And her meaning behind that is that even though she grew up in Australia and she has an Australian accent, that with a name like Kumi and the fact that she looks very Japanese, she felt that that had a very negative connotation of people would say, yeah, but where are you from, you know? And I just wondered with the whole third culture kid, and, you know, all of our kids always giggle about, you know, being asked where they're from is just so confusing for them because, you know, yes, you can say I'm from Australia, but I was born in Malaysia, but I then went and lived in Libya, and then I lived in Canada, and then I lived in Houston. I'm basically telling the story of my second child, right? And she has all of these things about her, and then she has this American accent, and, you know, that it's all very confusing to tell people. But I'd also never really thought about that. It's that question often comes from a space of negativity, that someone is saying, yeah, but where are you really from? Because you're so obviously not from here.
Yeah, so that's true, and that's told probably in this way in a very poignant and interesting way, whereas there's also that very funny video on YouTube where the American ladies out jogging. Yeah. The Asian American lady, and then she turns the tables back on the other person. But I often think that, and also I don't know whether this happened to you, Kirsty, but when I lived in Hong Kong, I met a lot of people who looked like they were from the area and from the region, but didn't speak the language, and to them it was very confronting and difficult because people expected them, because they looked like they did, to speak the language. But in fact, they'd come from English speaking countries where they'd never, and their families didn't. They'd been generations in other countries and couldn't actually speak the local language, which was also another kind of expat difficulty situation for them.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's been people that have written books about that as well. So yeah, no, this is good. We'll obviously have the link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, Kumi's Japan. It just came out October 15th on ABC iView. Definitely worth a look.
Okay, I think that's it for this week.
Woohoo!
Thanks to Valentina and thanks to Annabelle for getting back on the bandwagon with us. Thanks to everybody for listening. And if you have listened and have enjoyed it and haven't rated us before, perhaps you'd like to give us a rating or review in your favorite podcast app. Or we'd love to hear from you. We're on the socials, obviously, as @twofatexpats everywhere. And we also have an email address, twofatexpats@gmail.com. So let us know what you think and what you want to hear, because we always want to know that.
Okay, I'll see you next week, Nikki.
Speak to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.